na katulor ali fataga. Famloy ikawa na katulor ali fataga. Famloy ikawa na katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 67th of the Cthulhu podcast. We'll be opening with part 32 of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a musical number from the 1920s, and for the main feature, we're going to have an original story called The Thing in the Chasm by David Lindblad. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 32. We hung the buck in a tree. The colonel returned, and not long afterward one of the paddlers who had been watching the river called out to us that there was a tapir in the water, a good distance upstream, and that two of the other boats were after it. We jumped into the canoe, and the two paddlers dug their blades into the water as they drove her against the strong current, edging over for the opposite bank. The tapir was coming downstream at a great rate, only its queer head above the water. While the dugouts were closing rapidly on it, the paddlers uttered loud cries. As the tapir turned slightly to one side or the other, the long, slightly upturned snout and the strongly pronounced arch of the crest along the head and upper neck gave it a marked and unusual aspect. I could not shoot, for it was directly in line with one of the pursuing dugouts. Suddenly it dived, the snout being slightly curved downward as it did so. There was no trace of it. We gazed eagerly in all directions. The dugout in front came alongside our canoe, and the paddlers rested, their paddles ready. Then we made out the tapir, clambering up the bank. It had dived at right angles to the course it was following, and swum under water to the very edge of the shore, rising under the overhanging tree branches at a point where a drinking trail for game led down a break into the bank. The branches partially hid it, and it was in deep shadow, so that it did not offer a very good shot. My bullet went into its body too far back, and the tapir disappeared in the forest at a gallop, as if unhurt, although the bullet really secured it, by making it unwilling to trust to its speed and leave the neighbourhood of the water. Three or four of the hounds were by this time swimming the river, leaving the others yelling on the opposite side, and as soon as the swimmers reached the shore, they were put on the tapir's trail and galloped after it, giving tongue. In a couple of minutes we saw the tapir take to the water far upstream, and after it we went as fast as the paddles would urge us through the water. We were not in time to head it, but fortunately some of the dogs had come down to the river's edge at the very point where the tapir was about to land and turned it back. Two or three of the dogs were swimming. We were more than half the breadth of the river away from the tapir, and somewhat downstream when it dived. It made an astonishingly long swim beneath the water this time, almost as if it had been a hippopotamus, for it passed completely under our canoe and rose between us and the thither bank. I shot it, the bullet going into its brain, while it was 30 or 40 yards from shore. It sank at once. There was nothing to do now but wait until the body floated. I feared that the strong current would roll it downstream over the riverbed, but my companions assured me that this was not so, and that the body would remain where it was until it rose, which would be in an hour or two. They were right, except as to the time. For over a couple of hours we paddled or anchored ourselves by clutching branches close to the spot, or else drifted down a mile and paddled up again near the shore to see if the body had caught anywhere. Then we crossed the river and had lunch at the lovely natural picnic ground where the buck was hung up. We had very nearly given up on the tapir when it suddenly floated only a few rods from where it had sunk. With no little difficulty, the big round black body was hoisted into the canoe, and we all turned our prows downstream. The skies had been lowering for some time, and now, too late to interfere with the hunt or cause us any annoyance, a heavy downpour of rain came on and beat upon us. Little we cared as the canoe raced forward, with the tapir and the buck lying in the bottom, and a dry, comfortable camp ahead of us. When we reached camp, and Father Zahm saw the tapir, he reminded me of something I had completely forgotten. When, some 6 years previously, he had spoken to me in the White House about taking this South American trip, I had answered that I could not, as I intended to go to Africa, but added that I hoped some day to go to South America, and that if I did so, I should try and shoot both a jaguar and a tapir, as they were characteristic big game animals of the country. "Well," said Father Zahm, "now you've shot them both." The storm continued heavy until after sunset. Then the rain stopped, and the full moon broke through the cloud rack. Father Zam and I walked up and down in the moonlight, talking of many things, from Dante to our own plans for the future, to the deeds and wanderings of the old-time Spanish conquistadors in their search for the Gilded King, and of the Portuguese adventurers who then divided with them the mastery of the oceans and of the unknown continents beyond. This was an attractive and interesting camp in more ways than one. The vaqueros and their wives and families were housed on the two sides of the field in which our tents were pitched. On one side was a big whitewashed tile-roofed house in which the foreman dwelt, an olive-skinned, slightly built, wiry man with an olive-skinned wife and eight as pretty, fair-haired children as one could wish to see. He usually went barefoot, and his manners were not merely good, but distinguished. Corrals and outbuildings were near this big house. On the opposite side of the field stood the row of steep-roofed, palm-thatched huts in which the ordinary cowhands lived with their dusky helpmeets and children. Each night from these palm-thatched quarters we heard the faint sounds of a music that went far back of civilization to a savage ancestry nearby in point of time and otherwise immeasurably remote, for through that still, hot air under the brilliant moonlight we heard the monotonous throbbing of a tom-tom drum and the twanging of some old stringed instrument. The small black turkey buzzards, here always called crows, were as tame as chickens near the big house, walking on the ground or perched in the trees beside the corral, waiting for the offal of the slaughtered cattle. Two palm trees near our tent were crowded with the long-hanging nests of one of the cacarique orioles. We lived well, with plenty of tapir beef, which was good, and venison of the bush deer, which was excellent, and as much ordinary beef as we wished, and fresh milk, too, a rarity in this country. There were very few mosquitoes, and everything was as comfortable as possible. The tapir I killed was a big one. I did not wish to kill another unless, of course, it became advisable to do so for food, whereas I did wish to see some specimens of the big white-lipped peccary, the quixia, pronounced cachiada, of the Brazilians, which would make our collection of the big mammals of the Brazilian forests almost complete. The remaining members of the party killed two or three more tapirs. One was a bull, full-grown, but very much smaller than the animal I had killed. The hunters said that this was a distinct kind. The skull and skin were sent back with the other specimens to the American Museum, where after due examination and comparison its specific identity will be established. Tapirs are solitary beasts. Two are rarely found together, except in the case of a cow and its spotted and streaked calf. They live in dense cover, usually lying down in the daytime and at night coming out to feed, and going to the river or to some lagoon to bathe and swim. From this camp, Sieg took Lieutenant Lyra back to Caceres to get something that had been overlooked. They went in a rowboat to which the motor had been attached, and at night on the way back almost ran over a tapir that was swimming. But in unfrequented places, tapirs both feed and bathe during the day. The stomach of the one I shot contained big palm nuts. They had been swallowed without even mastication to break the kernel, the outer pulp being what the tapir prized. Tapirs gallop well, and their tough hide and wedge shape enable them to go at speed through very dense cover. They try to stamp on and even to bite a foe, but are only clumsy fighters. The music for today is a track by the Albert Wynn's Gut Bucket 5, with Punch Miller guest starring. It's a 1928 track that's a real foot-tapper, and it's called Parkway Stomp. Thank you. And now for our main feature. The author, David Lindblad, submitted this story to the podcast nearly 6 months ago, and I've only just got round to it. Thanks for being patient, David. The Thing in the Chasm by David Lindblad. There is a grave, now tenantless, in the Arkham graveyard just south of Washington Street and east of Boundary Street. The grave in question is that of one Benjamin Morris, my once learned friend and professor at Miskatonic University, here in Horium, which cursed Arkham, Massachusetts. Knowing this, coupled with the horror he and I witnessed in that blasphemous and demonic pit, I now fear for my own well-being and sanity. For those who thought him mad, gibbering of unseen evils constantly present and active, these same detractors may believe otherwise after having read this ghastly and unfortunately authentic account of our travels and our discovery. My only hope is that with the unburdening of this account from my mind and soul, no more hapless or incredulous men find their fate mumbling in a madhouse like this last deplorable year of the late Benjamin Morris. In May of 1924, I had recently returned from a protracted and thoroughly comprehensive expedition to the Himalayan mountains near the kingdom of Nepal. Upon my return from this perilous archaeological trek, the stories of all that I had witnessed, as well as my experiences with a rather bizarre and much maligned cult that seemed to plague nearly our every movement through the region with a growing satanic fever, were captured in many newspapers. Very little of the latter was mentioned, however, in any of the articles that were run in various papers around New England. Many precocious young journalists, looking to add a sensational element to the cold archaeological data I had comprised, had interviewed me, and I was more than willing to furnish them with any noteworthy information I had to offer. In most instances, a rather stoic picture of myself beside an antique mahogany davenport and credenza accompanied the article of my findings, the former having been covered in newly procured artifacts from my most recent voyage. These artifacts included, but were not limited, to different simple stone statues, various pieces of gold and silver, ancient-looking collections of earthenware and other miscellaneous objects of questionable origin and as yet unknown age. Upon the credenza lay various tomes of olden times, ranging from the contemporary to the occult and macabre. These volumes included The Ghoulish Cults de Ghouls by the Comte d'Erlet, the forbidden panoptic manuscripts, or fragments thereof, as well as The People of the Monolith by Justin Jeffrey. I had acquired these books of lore and curse through my various adventures through the world and leapt at the chance to procure each of them. Within a month, the attention from the reporters had waned, and I was at long last able to devote time to the careful study and categorization of my still mysterious treasure trove. However, a peculiar thing arrived for me, postmarked from a Professor Benjamin Morris. It had appeared that something in the newspapers had aroused his interest in me, but more specifically in something I had found and hung on display in my study that I had intended to analyze when afforded the opportunity. It would seem that in the photograph printed in the Arkham Advisor, the lower left-hand quarter of a bas-relief had been captured. I was most fascinated in this bas-relief, and was surprised that the professor's zeal and appreciation for it surpassed even my own. It was seemingly carved from a peculiar stone that baffled all to whom I had shown it. I could not attempt to identify it, for I was almost wholly ignorant of geology or mineralogy. The stone facade was roughly 2 feet in width and 4 feet in height, with somewhat ragged edges, suggesting it had come from perhaps a larger, more significant sculpture. This stone was jet black in colour, and seemed, at least in slight, to produce an aura of darkness that absorbed light sources around it, yet reflecting no sheen, despite its highly polished surface. Upon its face was an utterly alien form of hieroglyphs, which upon initial study I could not decode. What had also proven peculiar about this relief was that although the outer stone was black, as I have mentioned, the carvings into the face revealed a rather brilliant and somewhat phosphorescent quality. I was sure the latter was an optical illusion or half-fancied idea that it exuded. These qualities, however, would not have been wholly or even partially captured in the dim black-and-white photograph displayed in the advisor. This inspired in me an immediate admiration for this man's keen eye for detail. The letter from the professor was accompanied by 2 photographs, and read as follows. Dear Mr. Burnham, First, may a stranger offer congratulations on your recent expedition. A particularly astute student of mine alerted me to an article which captured his interest due to the esoteric subject matter. My name is Benjamin Morris, and I am a professor of anthropology at Miskatonic University. Please do not take this the wrong way, but I use my contacts within the Arkham Advisor, specifically my old friend Adelaide Smythe, who happens to be a senior editor. He did not understand my interest in it, unfortunately, being a man of more mundane pursuits. Though I'm sure the entirety of your trip was quite a story, of particular interest to me were the photographs of you included in the article detailing your return. In case the details remain vague in the wake of the post-expedition excitement, I mention specifically that the photograph of you standing in front of that magnificent bas-relief was the thing that most caught my attentions. Though it was slightly marred by a lack of clarity in the film, I was still quite quick to recognize the hieroglyphs etched upon its face. I have seen few of such specimens in my studies and travels, and happen to have come into possession of a small handful of them. This particular piece, which I discovered in Queensland, of all places, possesses several similar traits to that of your own. Enclosed in this letter, I have included two photographs I believe you will find quite intriguing. In lieu of further words, I shall leave the photographs for you to judge. Signed, Professor Benjamin Morris, Miskatonic University, Arkham, Massachusetts. The images he had sent me were of a singular quality and of a perplexing nature. Within the first photograph, I beheld a rather unassuming man with wire-frame spectacles, standing behind an utterly extrinsic yet familiar collection of books and artifacts. The man of moderate height, which I presumed to be Professor Morris, was stout and stood with his rotund arms folded about his chest. He possessed softened facial features that seemed to somewhat hide or cloak his moderate age, giving the illusion of exaggerated youth despite his aged demeanour and somewhat waning hairline. The second snapshot I beheld, however, ignited an intense curiosity that was soon overcome by sheer horror. For standing besides the same spectacled man was something that, had I known the implications of at the time, would have made me burn the letter and both those snapshots to cinders. Rising perhaps a foot beyond Benjamin's own height, and standing wider than he as well, was a wooden crate that was evidently unveiled solely for this particular showing, if the heap of canvas laying next to it yielded me the correct conjecture. The object in this crate was akin to the bas-relief that hung upon my own wall, but to a magnitude nigh incomparable, for not only did this larger relief boast in brilliant contrast the unrecognizable hieroglyphs, but also depicted something far more insidious. I gazed in awe whilst unknown amounts of time passed. I could not avert my eyes, for what lay before me was a carving which seemed to bear no tool marks, a trait not altogether too extraordinary, for this effigy seemed not of this earth, or perhaps even this universe. In the centre of this mysterious monolith was carved a creature, or creature of sorts, that nearly defied description. What my eyes yielded to my mind was an amorphous entity with gnarled and writhing tentacles reaching in all directions, yet had no concrete structure to it. With one great eye in its centremost apex, it seemed to peer through endless voids of space and time directly into my soul, and instilled in me repulsion and terror. Its very existence seemed to mock all natural law and order. This object pictured before me could not have come from the mind of any sane man, for it was, in essence, the epitome of twisted ideas and malevolent form. It was, as it had been hinted at in the dreaded Necronomicon, and mentioned by Benjamin Morris in his letter. This hideous caricature was something from outside of our space and time. I responded to the letter the very moment I had regained composure, expressing my astonishment at what I had learned and was yet to learn. Although he had not been able to ascertain the origin of the strange and dreadful hieroglyphs, I was still most interested in any knowledge on the subject. I enclosed within my letter a portrait of the artifact for further study, hoping to aid Professor Morris in any way. In the interim, I laboured towards interpreting, as best I could, my own bas-relief with the materials and resources at my disposal, a feat that proved impossible with my limited library of elder scripts and various theorems of decrypting code. This language, represented in decadent forms, held fast and unbending to any known form of speech to which I had subjected it. I surmised that this specimen must be far older than any other language living or dead, holding secrets of untold vigitillions of years. Yet through all of the countless hours spent under the glow of my electric desk light, bent over dozens of manuscripts, I could not rid my mind of the image I had seen in that photograph. It had all but suffocated any other thoughts, causing my dreams to become plagued with ghastly visions of unnameable monstrosities and cyclopean structures, and of yawning black depths tenanted by some unseen terror that made itself known by great rumblings and foul smell. These visions came infrequently at first, but rather quickly had become habitual. I soon found myself avoiding sleep at all costs, seeking relief from these hellish bergs and lurkers in nebulous depths. It was fully 2 weeks before I had received word back from the professor at Miskatonic. I was beginning to believe that I had been the object of some elaborate hoax, and that all the visions had been plagued me were so purely productions of my own imagination. My fears found horrible affirmation to the contrary with the arrival of his belated letter. Again, my correspondence has long since been lost to me, but as memory serves, this is how the second letter ran. "Dear Mr. Burnham, the arrival of your photographs excited me greatly. Being able to compare your photographs side by side with my own piece, I was intrigued to see that many of the hieroglyphs were identical. While they will continue to be studied by me as well into the future, they unfortunately did not reveal anything of significance in decoding my own piece. Unfortunately, without a key word, these symbols form an unbreakable code. That being said, it would interest me greatly to be able to examine your piece in person, and also extend you the same courtesy. I would be delighted if we were able to meet and exchange experiences, notes, and speculations. Please inform me of a time when you are able. Noting the size of your artifact, I would think it more appropriate if you arrange for transport here with portability in your favour as compared to my own. In summary, Mr. Burnham, we need to have a chat. Sincerely, Professor Benjamin Morris, Miskatonic University, Arkham, Massachusetts." I had been disappointed that his conclusions were that of my own regarding the hieroglyphs, and was intrigued at the idea of another fact-finding mission. What was first to be addressed was a meeting in the flesh. From the return address on the envelopes, I learned from a city map that Benjamin Morris lived on the north-east side of Arkham, near Independence Square, across the Miskatonic River. My own lodgings and office were both near the intersection of W. Saltonstall Street and S. Peabody Avenue, about 17 miles away as the crow flies. I quickly sent word that I was more than willing to join Professor Morris at his study at Miskatonic University, and could arrive the very next day with the artifact in tow after receiving notice. After 2 days of anxious waiting, I received a telegram on June 24th, informing me that I would be welcome the following day. I had to make haste, for a spell of absent-mindedness had gotten the better of me, and I had neglected to prepare my specimen for travel. With the aid of a rather muscular friend of mine, we had managed to load the relief into a large wooden crate with ample amounts of newspaper and straw to ensure its safety during the journey. In addition, I packed a valise with what manuscripts and documents I felt could possibly further our efforts, though their use solely to me had yielded nothing. That night, under a gibbous moon, sleep did not find me easily. I tossed about in my iron-framed bed, unable to find rest, for this night the visions were all the more corporal and intensified. After untold hours, I must have drifted into a fitful slumber, and with that found myself in an utterly alien landscape. As I looked about, I beheld that I was standing in the midst of a seemingly endless metropolis of cyclopean masonry. Enormous stone structures were in every direction, all dripping with some bizarre, viscous and fetid liquid. A stench filled the air that was of a freshly unveiled crypt after decades of decay. Despite the putrid dripping of this hideous liquid into gathering pools, no sound echoed throughout this nightmarish world. The excruciating silence of this hideous place was suddenly ripped asunder by a bone-chilling scream, which I was horrified to learn was my own. The sights of this frightening landscape quickly filled my mind with terror, and soon I found myself running through macabre nightmare alleys and burrows, although I was unaware of my own locomotion. Now a great rumbling broke out as I found myself coming to a halt at the edge of an immense chasm, whose far side was completely invisible to my eyes. One look into the yawning black abyss nearly sent my mind reeling towards an endless madness. The quaking ground became more furious, shaking my footing loose and causing me to plunge through the depths of this pitch-black aperture. It was from this fall that I had awakened in my room, teeming with perspiration, my heart pounding nearly out of my chest. I glanced frantically around my room, making quite sure I had been fully absolved of this nightmare. As my heavy breathing subsided, I glanced at my wall clock and found it to be a few minutes shy of 3 a.m. Giving that any further attention to the idea of sleep now wholly was out of the question, I arose from my bed and flipped on the light switch. The electric lights leapt into radiance, dispelling all the queer shadows that were cast about the room from the moonlight outside my window. With the new source of incandescence, it became clear how much I had stirred during my night terrors. My bed linens were strewn about the room with my personal effects, including my reading glasses, had all been knocked to the floor. I gathered the latter, placing all my personal items back upon my bedside table, and then amassed all my linens to be sent to the laundry. I spent the few remaining hours before daylight at the desk in my study, reassuring and convincing myself that my terrible night gaunts had been nothing more than the overstimulation and nervous excitement brought about by the coming day's trip and the scope thereof. At 8:30 a.m., a taxi arrived at my home, and the driver assisted me in loading my rather unwieldy package. With valise in hand, I entered the taxi and began my trip. I was to take this taxi to catch the 9:15 ferry across the Miskatonic, and when across, take another cab arriving at Miskatonic University around the hour of 11. When there, I hoped to finally quench my now extremely prolific curiosity. As the motor car rolled along the streets, the jostling subtly reminded me of the quaking and rumbling of my dreams, and I shuddered visibly. It seemed the driver took notice of this, but did not remark upon its strangeness. I collected myself, but could not alleviate myself of any uneasy feeling churning inside me. I decided to ponder the subject no further, and spent the rest of my ride in still silence, watching brick buildings and gambrel roofs pass the windows of my motor coach. With both modes of transport executing as I had planned, I soon found myself within the boundaries of the historic university. I had hired two rather shabby yet well-mannered negroes to transport my crate, allowing me to navigate and tend to my valise. By the clock tower of the university, it was 11:16, and I was pleased at the expediency of my trip. My hired hands and I made our way through the ivied campus, finally coming to rest outside a door that read, Professor Benjamin Morris, Anthropology. I instructed the men that I would no longer be needing their assistance, and paid them for their time. Once alone, I prepared myself, and knocked on the heavy wooden door. Anxiously I waited, and within moments the very same man from the photos now occupied the threshold where once the door had stood. He greeted me warmly, and motioned for two students, or what I presumed to be students, to bring my find inside. We exchanged polite banter about my journey as the students hoisted the crate up and onto the examination table. I deduced from his hesitation to speak of the subject at hand that he had not made his students privy to his studies in anything other than his field of anthropology. One of the students, a rather tall, youngish fellow with blonde hair and a square jaw, wiped his brow with a handkerchief he produced from his shirt pocket. The other student, who was much shorter, with dark features, placed a crowbar atop the crate, and both men bid the professor and me good day. Once we were alone with our collective knowledge and objects, we soon found much to talk about. Rather than pry the lid from the wooden box on the table, he instead motioned me to a chair opposite his desk. We began to speak of my travels, and I had eventually confided in him with regards to the strange and troublesome dreams that had filled my nights ever since I had received his first letter and photographs. At my mentioning of specifics of these visions, he started back and made definite visible motions of masked fear and timidity. After further inquiries, he reluctantly admitted to having similar experiences in his own dreams. This notion perturbed me greatly, as well it did the professor. We discussed the significance of the cyclopean buildings of stone, the fetid liquid that seemed to pour out every surface, and the gargantuan pit inhabited by some unseen evil. We were now sure that some permeating force was somehow entering our minds and implanting the notions of such terrifying things, but of what significance we were yet to discover. After our lengthy discussions and fearful conjectures, it finally came time to focus our attentions towards the further study of the blasphemous stones. I crossed the room from my chair and lifted the crowbar from the top of the crate and began prying the nails from its face. The professor, meanwhile, crossed the room in the opposite direction and produced a brass key from his breast pocket and unlocked a rather sound door at the far wall. While performing my labor, there came many sounds from the room the professor had entered. Removing the final nail, I turned, and my eyes were met with the sight of a sheeted stone monolith that now sat in the middle of the room. I was amazed at the speed with which this paunchy and unexercised man had produced this hulking statue. I had speculated that he had become quite adept at the solitary transferring of this object, having kept it with such guarded secrecy. I placed the crowbar back atop the crate, my interest now being drawn elsewhere, and sheepishly approached the towering, canvased figure. Professor Morris circled round to the front near me, and removed the canvas. God, though, I wish he had not. This abhorred thing, now standing before me in full brilliance, sent fright surging through my body as if delivered by a bolt of lightning. It was, in orders of magnitude, completely incomparable to my own relief. It had evidently been made of the same stone as that of my own, with its hideous light-swallowing quality and radiant red carvings. Its mere presence filled me with repulsion and hatred for reasons I could not place. But what was most alarming was that horrible carving of that outer-worldly thing splaying itself about the centre of those strange hieroglyphs. My gaze was locked upon this creature, its reaching tentacles seemingly gelatinous and putrid skin, and worst of it all, that Herculean eye planted in the middle of the damn thing. From this gruesome orb there seemed to project endless vistas of blackness, revolving multicoloured polyhedrons and unidentifiable cosmic horrors. I was beginning to feel faint, and must have appeared so because I found myself being steadied and finally led towards my chair. After a few moments I had gained most of my composure and piled my host with questions about the thing. Benjamin's more hearty constitution had prevailed him from being affected as dramatically as I. Even as I frantically spouted my many questions to him, I found that I could scarcely pull my eyes off of the thing. Sadly, he had little information to offer me as to its origin or meaning. However, he was able to recall that he had purchased it from a swarthy and mysterious merchant while on an archaeological dig in India. It seems he had been asked to accompany a team of archaeologists on a dig, hoping to discover pre-human remains near the Gadaya River. One night, after a day of labouring and study, a labourer that had been hired for the dig approached him. In terms of broken English, he requested Professor Morris follow him to a hidden grotto of which few others were aware, and that it would be worth his while if he did. According to his accounts, he gathered an electric torch and followed the curious man into the serpentine vines and trees, reaching out like corpse limbs. The details on the story he gave lacked slightly, and all that I could understand was that, while in this grotto, he had been presented the blasphemous artifact and purchased it without a haggle or hesitation. In expression of years, it had been fully 12 since the expedition, and he had spent countless hours in almost obsessive study of it since. Incidentally, he had learned that the man who had sold him the artifact had come to a rather sudden and terrible end at the hands of some unidentified group. These incidents seemed curious to me, though I decided to pry no further upon the matter. We spoke for hours, and it seemed time had gotten away from me when I finally glanced at my pocket watch. It was 12:30. It was now far too late to ring for a taxi, and even if I had, the ferry would not run again until 9:15 that morning. I inquired about local hotels, but the professor graciously insisted I spend the remainder of the night in his guest bedroom. I found this to be quite fortunate, for my planned spending did not allow for the expense of an overnight stay. Assuring me our prizes were quite safe in his office closet behind lock and key, I followed him to his home. It was a colonial period structure with high portico arches and high gable roof. I was led into a modest yet tastefully appointed guest bedroom furnished with antique bedstead, mirrored dresser, and a high-backed armchair set in the northeast corner of the room near a large window. I rested, fully dressed, upon the soft mattress, and dazed for a bit while pondering all I had heard. When sleep did find me, I had no frightful visions, and my dreams were set in the usual landscapes and peopled by familiar faces. This puzzled me, as the dreams had been steadily increasing in intensity and frequency, but I was grateful for the peace it had afforded me. In the morning, I found my host in good spirits, and waiting for me at his dining-room table with a breakfast of eggs, bacon, toast, and coffee. As we ate, we continued our musings on the night before with renewed vigour. It was this morning that the idea of a return trip was broached. I was uneasy about the idea of a return trip, the memories of the fiendish cult still fresh and off-putting. His methods of persuasion proved very effective, however, and it seemed that this opportunity was not to be overlooked. Safety was of the utmost importance, and we were to travel with a specially selected group of men that would assure no harm fall upon us. I would offer as much monetary assistance as I could, but was made to understand that in no uncertain terms that the professor would cover the bulk of the trip's expenditures. It would take 3 weeks to make all of the necessary arrangements for the voyage, and it was decided that I would gather all of my geographical data in preparation and return for departure as soon as I received the word. In the meantime, I had no small feat to accomplish. The 3 weeks had come and gone, and I had not yet heard from the professor. I collected all of my notes and relevant data on the region, as well as my personal journal, whose reference I am using even now as I write this horrible memoir. For now, however, there was nothing to do but eagerly wait and wonder of what was to come. Thankfully, I wasn't forced to wait long, for within 4 days of our original arrangement, a telegram was delivered informing me that the preparations were made and supplies collected. I was to rendezvous with the crew at a local seaport, where we would board a steamship we had commissioned for our sail. I wasted no time, and soon found myself loading boxes of rations and supplies onto a rather decrepit-looking sea vessel. Inquiries about the seaworthiness were met with reassuring comments and anecdotes from all who boarded. It was then that I had noticed the loading by crane of 2 very large crates that were placed in the hold of the ship. These parcels seemed to conjure an idea of familiarity, and this feeling puzzled me. They were, I found upon closer study, the crates containing our secreted stone prizes. Fearing discovery by the crew as to what the crates held, I decided to take note of it and solicit an answer from the professor when privacy was in our favour. As the days passed, it seemed the crew, hand-picked by Benjamin, had appeared more and more queer to me. I noticed they all shared a similar and peculiar likeness to one another, despite no blood relation. The men were gathered from around a decayed New England seaport unfamiliar to me, and as I understand, there were few men who could match these odd folk in seafaring. The skills of the men notwithstanding, I felt wholly uneasy around them. With bulging eyes that seemed never to blink, and skin of a greyish-green tint, I found nothing but repulsion from them. Damn them, and their abhorred smelling of rotting fish. The repugnance of their company I found I could not escape, so any privacy with the professor was now completely out of the question. I decided that I would keep to myself and chart our progress with my sextant and the stars by night. By my appraisal, we were making excellent time, and would reach land on or before schedule. The remainder of our voyage at sea passed without major discomfort, and I was very relieved to find that our deckhands did not wish to leave the vessel upon docking. Their refusal to leave the water did not seem to distress Benjamin at all, and furthermore, it seemed he was aware of this eventuality. Directing me to assist in the unloading of the ship, Benjamin secured a satchel over his shoulder and headed into a small fishing village to attain able-bodied men to aid in our passage. His choice of words, though seemingly harmless, chilled me slightly, though I made no mention of it. In the professor's absence, I rifled through my personal valise and removed a revolver from it, deciding it was perhaps more favourable to carry it on my person. It was not long before the professor returned with 12 stout men in tow. Though my feelings of uneasiness had not subsided, I gathered as much as I could carry, and with that we began our excursion towards the Himalayas of Nepal. Several days passed without incident, each day's travel producing prosaic scenery, and with each night rest and camaraderie around the fire. On the fourth night, however, something aroused my attention that I at first dismissed. As I sat beside the dancing flames of the campfire, jotting notes in my journal, I noticed a slight rustling just beyond the reach of the flame's light. This did not seem even partially unusual, for the sights and sounds of an encampment inherently arouse the interest of animal life in the area. With each advancing night, I began to notice more disconcerting events and phenomena. The rustling soon appeared to encircle the encampments from all sides, and soon Benjamin was obliged to sleep with a burning lantern and rather large-caliber rifle. My mind could find no repose. For now, through the branches and membranous leaves of the trees, there flickered many twin reflections of our own fire. From that moment hence, we were plagued with strange and horrible noises, and taunted from what we could not see or quite place. I pleaded constantly to turn back, and to give up our foolish and increasingly dangerous expedition, though my pleas fell upon deaf ears. I was assured that we were in no real danger, and that the men who travelled with us had been through more than enough to prepare them for any attacks levied. And this was apparently the case, for not one piece of equipment had been damaged, and not one among us had sustained any injury. Had I known that this was purely coincidental, I might have ventured back on my own, risking possible escape as opposed to what appeared to be certain peril. According to our guides, we were no more than 2 days' hike from our destination, and I was relieved, for the camp and unexplored mouth of a cave would be a paradise in comparison to the surrounding fright that stalked us. With my nerves frayed and tattered, I sat clutching my revolver on the last night before our scheduled arrival and deliverance from this hellish cacophony of noise and chatter. I must have dozed uneasily into a deep sleep, which brought more of the visions and night terrors I had back in Arkham. I was jostled from my delirium when something grazed my arm with incredible speed. Something had slashed through my layers of clothing and left a laceration on my upper arm. I sprang to my feet and discharged several of the rounds from my revolver in the direction it had escaped. The shots rang out through the night, and when the commotion had settled, all the eerie sounds and disturbances had ceased. Now only silence was in the air, a silence that left the men more chilled and frightened than our pursuers had. The following morning we broke camp, and by midday we had finally found what we had come so far and risked so much to see. My maps and notes indicated we were at the very spot I had found my bas-relief, what seemed like eons ago. We stood now in the mouth of a great cave that dwarfed us to an incredible degree. The professor ordered we make camp and begin our explorations as soon as possible. The professor pulled me to one side and explained to me that he was wary of allowing the entire party to join us as we examined the cave. So he instructed me to choose 4 men I deemed fit. I chose those whom I considered to be best able, both physically and mentally, and Professor Morris instructed them to hoist our tandem wooden crates for embark into the great stone maw. My excitement was now steadily overcoming the fear instilled in me by our sojourn through the jungle, though not so much as to be disinclined from carrying my revolver. I had gathered some fresh water and 2 electric pocket torches for use in the dark recesses of the cavern. The mouth and the first few metres of the cave were rather unremarkable. Gathering pools of water fed by dripping stalactites echoed small splashes throughout as we pressed on. The labourers struggled to keep pace with us as Benjamin seemed to rush through the stone labyrinth, almost as though he was drawn to some point within. The daylight from the aperture grew dim quickly as we continued on, so much so that before long I was inclined to ignite one of the pocket torches. An hour had passed as we travelled on, and the batteries of my light began to fail. We were by now, I assumed, miles beneath the surface of the earth. It was then that the professor began to survey our surroundings. We had come to rest in a rather large dome chamber, whose walls seemed to be carved smooth. I produced my 2nd electric torch, and soon found that the walls, though seemingly smooth, were in fact covered in hieroglyphs. I ran my fingers over the carvings, and was amazed at the quantity and elaborate style with which they had been etched. Millions of these characters lined the walls, and I was awestruck to the point of speechlessness. My gaze now turned towards Benjamin, to glean any impression from him that I could. I found him in a frantic state, rifling through his pack, finally producing a rather large and ancient-looking tome. I turned the ray of my flashlight towards it, and saw that it was none other than the dreaded Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, obviously on loan from the Miskatonic, with or without permission. There was a frenzy of pages turning until he had come to what he was searching for. My awe had not left me, and I sat observing, but not quite understanding all that was going on around me. He raised one hand, making several odd gestures, and mumbled a phrase that I could not quite discern. Upon the completion of his recitation, he lowered his head and exhaled deeply. He appeared disappointed by the inaction of his chant, when suddenly the walls and floor of the chamber began to quake. The sound was deafening, as bits of rubble fell from the walls and ceiling. I clutched at my revolver in anticipation and fear of what was to happen. Within a few moments, a large section at the far end of the cell fell back slightly and slid ominously out of view. My nerves were now beyond management, and I shut my eyes, rubbing them with clenched fists. Words still escaping me, I watched as Benjamin replaced the book in his pack and motioned for our labourers and me to follow his lead. Reluctantly we did so, after dusting our shaking and disorientated figures. What had just transpired in that small dome structure had not even begun to prepare me for what we found when we made it through that secret passage. I stood awestruck and stifled a scream stemming from what I now beheld. It was the very same terrible cyclopean city from my nightmares. We now stood where no man in any state should dwell. Our insignificant figures now occupied the outer cusp of the place I was sure could not have existed. I heard the dripping of that thick and fetid liquid oozing from all surfaces, something I knew all too well. My knees began to fail me, and I stumbled a bit to reclaim my balance. I cast my gaze upon the professor for some sort of direction, more from habitual insistence than actual aid. I found him in a state of revelry over our discovery. Falling to his knees, he shouted triumphantly upward, his screams echoing and filling my very core with fear and revulsion. The labourers stood trembling behind their cargo, visibly as shaken as I. Benjamin arose, barking orders to hoist their loads and keep moving. He then placed his arm around me, and he began to lead me as he spoke of ghastly and wild theories. "We are not at the top, my dear Burnham," he said. "We are merely a by-product of an even greater and ageless society. There are things that lie outside of space and time as we know it. These things found a home on our planet, though they could have had any they chose. Over countless eons they found themselves cast into a deep slumber, manipulating that which was around them through their dreams. The great old ones, they have shown you and me this place, and need our help. We have been summoned here by the Shoggoth." My senses were now numbed by everything I was forced to absorb, and I simply nodded at all he was saying. Meanwhile, the colossal stone structures passed us as we walked onward, to where I could not tell. These alleys of the damned that haunted my dreams, now in sharp relief, were standing larger than life before me. My mind reeled as my feeble brain tried to grasp and place in a chronological order all that had transpired in my dreams. I was thinking that perhaps I could determine the sordid outcome of this overwhelming event. A new terror was instilled in me as we stumbled upon my dream's penultimate culmination, for we now stood trembling at the outer lip of a gigantic, yawning abyss of impenetrable blackness. This chasm, spanning a distance immeasurable, gaped upward, and I could scarcely comprehend what lay before my eyes. The labourers now held back, muttering words of fright to one another as Benjamin once more reached deep into his pack and reproduced that copy of the Necronomicon. He bid the crates be opened, and their contents placed before him side by side. As they did so, he also retrieved a small vial of phosphorescent red liquid and another of green. I questioned his actions, but as if possessed by some malign force, he continued his work mechanistically. As the tablets were laid before him, he stood referencing that demonic book. I was now clutching my revolver, for fear that I would be forced into some sacrificial role to placate a cosmic or outer-worldly evil. Lifting his hand and motioning towards the great pit, he began to read from the book. These words, if one can call them words, were in no tongue of this earth, and the professor's recitation of them chilled me to the bone, each blasphemous syllable stinging my brain and echoing in my ears. These words are as follows, as closely as I can tell from the speaker's pauses and diction.
Grinagna, Skulinningatha, Ruglothan, Shoggoth, Asglinia.
He repeated this phrase as his voice grew louder and more commanding. He paused after the third repetition, and lifted the strange bottles of glowing liquid over his head. After a fourth repetition, he cast the bottles into the pit, and shouted, "Shoggoth!" With the casting of those liquids down that hellish void, the ground began to violently shake, as though something monolithic was gyrating beneath us. Benjamin now did something I thought impossible. Gazing at the stone's relief before him, he began to read aloud the text to which he proclaimed complete ignorance. The trembling became fiercer as he finished reading the smaller of the two, and began to deliver that hideous inscription of the larger, all the while the carved eye of the creature taking on a quality of phosphorescence. From this I had surmised that I had stumbled upon a missing piece of some demonic and malevolent instructions designed to call forth an evil that would rip the world asunder and plunge all of mankind into chaos. I shouted wildly at the professor, trying to dissuade him from his inhuman deed. My shouts, however, were completely drowned out by the ensuing dissonance and commotion. I scrambled wildly with the labourers, vainly in effort of discovering shelter from what was undeniably being called forth. We simply crowded together as they recited some sort of prayer, and I monitored the chasm for signs of horrible movement or change. My constant stare was not without horrible consequence, for as Benjamin spoke the final words, a most loathsome and nightmarish being then made itself known to us. For from that gaping, awful maw there now protruded a flabby, gelatinous tentacle, probing and grasping about. The hideous creature that sprang forth was the Shoggoth, a creature hinted at in the Necronomicon, and mentioned to me by the professor as a creature of extreme and awesome power. The monstrosity now heaved its disgusting visage into full view, an image I shall never alleviate from my mind. Its tentacles flailed, and its great piercing eye loomed over us like that of a cursed and mutated moon. A malevolent symphony of fiendish gurgles emitted from its putrid body, and the experience was too much to bear. It would prove so for one of the hired hands, as he clutched at his chest, and expired seemingly from sheer fright. I averted my stare for fear that the sight of this blasphemous beast should cause me to slip into a spiralling madness. It was then the three remaining workers turned to flee this stone city of the damned. This act of fear had caught the attention of the blasted thing, instigating harsh retaliation. The three men were seized by the Shoggoth and pulled to their grisly fate, their screams fading into silence from the dark recesses of the creature's once resting place. The professor's frantic cackling soon gave way to shrieks of terror and madness, for no human mind could observe such an outer-worldly thing and retain any semblance of sanity. The stone eye of the creature's likeness now blazed, emitting colours outside the earthly spectrum. Gathering my last ounce of willpower and courage, I discharged all six chambers of my revolver, and upon completion, fainted from the scene. I regained consciousness, not knowing where I was. I gazed about what seemed to be a makeshift hospital. To my left, still sleeping, was Benjamin. A man entered the room, and seeing I was awake, drew close and explained how I had come to rest there. He was a slender man of light skin and red hair, and I was confused owing to the fact that I had not seen anyone of his complexion since our departure from New England. He explained that the remainder of our hired crew had brought us here after a day's absence. This hospital, I presumed, was erected by a group of English missionaries, if the man's accent was any indication. The details of our arrival were few, for a lack of explanation from our saviours, and I began to wonder if it all had been a delusion brought about by a fever contracted during our travels. The young man questioned me about our trip, and I answered his questions as vaguely as I could, for fear he may think me mad. My feigned ignorance seemed to convince the man our exploits were wholesome, and whose scope was no more than an expedition of anthropological data from the region. This satisfied his curiosity fully, and he informed me that within the week my companion and I would be fit for travel. The notion that my experiences had been nothing more than a feverish nightmare was wiped from my mind with the sight of something that occupied the corner of the room. I broke into a cold sweat, for in the corner not only were my valise and the professor's pack, but lying upon a nearby table were a few shards of light swallowing jet-black stone, shards with strange hieroglyphs carved into their surface. In the following weeks, we had returned to Arkham, and the jabbering shell of a man known as Professor Morris was committed to the asylum. I had destroyed the fragments of stone and burned all manuscripts regarding either of them from our journey. The only proof of our joint venture is this account, and I pray that whoever comes across it will not repeat our actions for the sake of the world and humanity. The shots I fired from my revolver were not aimed at the putrid horror that came out of space and time, but at the tablets that held the instructions to call forth such an abomination. I know not whether I banished the beast with the destruction of our bas-reliefs, or simply delayed it. If there exist more copies of those blasphemous texts, for the sake of our world, I hope they are never uncovered. Now with the missing body and empty grave of Benjamin Morris, perhaps his ramblings of malign beings following, watching and waiting were in fact truth, and not simply ravings of madness. and now and then I come under the distinct impression of unseen lurkers in the darkness. No amount of sedatives or sleep can dispel such feelings. For if they do have planned for me what they had for the Professor, I'd sooner bring about my own demise than have it brought upon me from cosmic evils. My revolver is always handy, for one day I may need to turn it upon myself. Well, that's it for today. Except I'm going to break with tradition and run a promo for another podcast.
Great coffee.
Hey. Chad, who's that strange, somber man on the cover of that book you're reading?
Oh, that's H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, I've heard of him, but I never really got into his stuff. It's kind of strange and hard to read.
No, I used to think that too, but that all changed when I started listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
What's that?
The H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast is a weekly podcast.
Tell me more.
Well, these two really smart and hilarious guys give a synopsis of the story, then they talk about its background, the critical views, and what it says about the author.
Well, where can I listen?
Let me tell you, Chris, you can go to hppodcraft.com or, heck, just subscribe through iTunes. It's that easy.
Oh, Chad, I'm so excited. Now I can listen to this podcast and pretend to all my snooty friends that I actually read and understand H.P. Lovecraft.
Hey, that's what I do.
Oh, dear.
Yeah! HPPodcraft.com.
Opening music provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released under an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.